Hi, today's July 18th, 2015. This is Mobile News Podcast 123, or 123. And I'm Tato Gasawart, my good friend John Westfall. Just a couple of notes. There's no podcast for the next 2 weeks, probably. I might ask for a guest podcaster, but John will be traveling here and there.
I have important engagements away from my computer, so yep. I shall not be able to join you in this wonderful endeavor that we do weekly.
So one of the things we will not be discussing is, well, we will discuss, but after the fact, is the Windows 10 launch, which happens on July 29th, in between those two quiet weeks.
You know, it's just not a launch if you can't go somewhere at midnight and eat pizza while you wait for the countdown and then buy a box and go home and install it. And yeah, it's no launch.
Which was the launch that Microsoft had, like party things you could buy, like, you know, Windows plates and Piper plates.
That was Windows 7.
Was that 7?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I remember going to the Windows 7 launch in New York and getting like a little goodie bag that had Windows 7 playing cards and other random weird things, all from that whole push.
Yeah. Of course, this time around, they're giving away something too, but it's Windows. It's going to be free.
Mm-hmm. Well, for a little while.
For a year, right? And not for every, and not free in the sense of everything free, but if you've got Windows now, it's free, because I think they're selling the Windows 10 on a USB stick for like $100-something. It's not exactly cheap either.
Yeah, it's very interesting, the kind of ramifications. This is the first Windows release we've seen after Apple has kind of decided to make all of their releases free for existing customers. And of course, you can't be a new customer. You have to buy Apple hardware to get Apple OS, at least if you don't want to go the Hackintosh route. So. Yeah. This is interesting to see Microsoft kind of saying, okay, I guess we can do this, but we're not going to give up fully because we still want $100 a pop on each real new license.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll have a lot more to say after we see the actual launch and everybody has a chance to play with it for a week or so. I've been playing Windows 10 preview on my Dell Venue 8 Pro tablet for, wow, maybe almost a year. Not quite a year. 10 months, something like that. But in any case...
Well, you have to discount the time that you couldn't use the tablet because the Windows 10 preview had worked.
That's right. That was for a while, too. That's okay. I've used it for about 8 months.
Yeah. There was a little bit less time than what you were hoping.
Okay. A couple other things. We really don't have any big topics this week, but a whole bunch of little topics, which we found interesting, or at least mildly interesting. And the first one that I found more mildly annoying than mildly interesting was Amazon Prime 20th anniversary sale on a 9 Prime day on July 15th, where they claimed it was going to be bigger than Black Friday. And TechCrunch says reported that sales were up 80% that day, I guess, compared to other Wednesdays or whatever that day was. But for me, it was a complete bust. I didn't buy a darn thing.
You know, there were a few things I was watching as the deals were launching, and I thought, okay, if it goes below X, I'd look at the price it was at now and then go, okay, if it goes below this, I'll buy it. And none of them went as low as I was hoping. And I wasn't hoping for, you know, 50% off, but I was hoping for 30, 40% off maybe, and what I kept getting was 20 and 15%, which wasn't exactly what I was hoping for.
Yeah, and for me, the problem was... maybe because of my time zone, but it actually started the night before for me because it started at 9 p.m., at midnight Pacific time. Is that right? Yeah, I think it started midnight Pacific time, which is, you know, still mid-evening for me. So I actually leapt on, and even then, you know, a few minutes after launch, a number of items had been waitlisted, like the Amazon Echo, their intelligence, you know, cylindrical speaker system that is getting pretty good commentary in the tech community. And it wasn't that cheap. It went down from, I think, what is it, $199 list? Mm. It was down to about $129. But it was already 100% wait list full, so I couldn't even get on the wait list to order it. And it was similar for other items that I found interesting, like, you know, USB thumb drives and SD cards and things like that. You know, throughout the day, I would pop on my Amazon app on my phone and see that, oh, these are already 100% waitlisted, so I couldn't even order them.
Yeah, quantities were very limited on even things that you wouldn't necessarily think. So I was looking at a the Blue Yeti microphone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That I was thinking about picking up. And I went to the page when the deal launched. I was there when it hit zero and it launched.
Yeah.
I looked at something on the page for, I think, maybe a minute. And when I hit the buy button, I was already too late.
Yeah.
So I don't think necessarily people are running out to buy a Blue Yeti microphone. I have a feeling that there some of these of quantities, yeah, were five of them. And yeah. then when they were gone, they were gone. So. Yeah.
Well, I guess they're trying to build, maximize the hype while minimizing their sales profits reduction.
Yeah. So it was, I think it was an interesting thing to see. I'd love to see more companies like Amazon do these sorts of deals, but it wasn't something to take a day off work and sit there and wait for each deal to roll in and at the end of the day have to take out a second mortgage to pay for all your new Amazon gear. But yeah. it was a decent – it was a sale. It wasn't a super sale. It wasn't bigger than Black Friday. It was a sale.
Okay. And the next item is something that Microsoft announced a while back but is now actually available, and that's their Microsoft's Universal Folding Keyboard. And the universal part is because it plays nicely with Apple devices and with Android devices as well as with Windows devices. The draw is that it folds. Now, there are other folding keyboards in the past. You own some, I'm sure. I know mm-hmm. I own a couple. But this one has a big, giant honking space, like a, you know, like the space between Dave Letterman's teeth that he often makes fun of.
Yeah, it's about that size. And it's... You know, I get it that if you are a 100% pure touch typist, and I'm a touch typist, I don't think I ever stray regularly over to the other side of the keyboard with the wrong hand. But, you know, occasionally, especially if you're trying to hit a certain sort of keystroke or something like that, you may have a use case where you want to reach up from, I'm looking down here, from G to U or something like that. Yeah. And this would kind of get annoying if that was what you were doing. Yeah. But... I mean, I don't think it's horrible. I think it's weird. It looks funny.
Well,
but,
for me, the problem is, and I've had one other folding keyboard that has space like that. My problem is when I type, I hit the space bar dead center, regardless if it's my left or right thumb. And that space is dead center, so I'm going to be hitting empty space if I use that thing.
Have you thought about getting your thumb looked at? Because I don't think I do that. So
really?
I think you're... Well, I'm looking right now. I guess I hit maybe at 40% on my left thumb, and then maybe at 60% on my right of the bar. So, I guess that is the problem. It's interesting. I hadn't thought of that one.
I'm using a MacBook Air as we speak to record this. And if you look at a MacBook Air keyboard, which is, you know, a little smaller than most keyboards, but both of my thumbs are right beneath the B key. Which is right in the middle of the space. And that's just how I type. I don't know if I learned it as a kid how to do it that way or just developed that over time. But I had one other keyboard with a split like that, and I always was hitting dead air, essentially. So the answer is, to me, if you really want a Microsoft product keyboard, they have a non-folding universal keyboard, which I think is exactly the same as this one, except cheaper and doesn't fold. That works pretty darn well. And it's what I use, and I would suggest taking a look at that.
And that one that you have, how many devices can it pair to simultaneously? Well, you know, they can switch on and off, too.
Okay, this is the weird thing. As far as I can figure out one. So if you have an iOS device, a Windows device, an Android device, it can pair to exactly one of those at a time.
Okay.
You can repair, you know, if you want to move from Android to iPhone or something like that, which I've tried to do. And that's how I found out it only really pairs with one device at a time. And I've had to repair it every time.
Because the new one is supposed to have two devices, but I had heard that the old one had support for multiple devices. But maybe that means you could just repair it as many times as you need to.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought, too. I thought, cool, you know, I have both Android and iOS devices. I thought, oh, good, I could, you know, pair it with both my phones, since I carry an Android phone and an iPhone. But that was not to be, so it's
what we just need.
Phone.
Is a keyboard that has four slots for different pairing profiles and a little indicator light, and you just hit a button and it cycles down the indicators and you know what it's going to pair to. But
I think Logitech may have a keyboard that does something like that, but I haven't purchased this. I haven't tested it.
I haven't ever found a really good regular use for a folding keyboard, mostly because if I need to do real work, I have a laptop with me, so I just pull that out. But at some point, I may have to buy a new keyboard. I'm still making do with a Think Outside Bluetooth folding keyboard.
Those.
from, I think, about 7 years ago. So
maybe more. I think mine's about 10 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the use case for me is I don't travel much, but when I do travel, I don't carry a notebook anymore. I haven't carried a notebook since probably 2011 or 2012. Probably 2011. So it's been about 4 or 5 years since I've carried a notebook regularly when I travel. And so if I think I'm going to be typing, you know, a bit, email, that sort of thing, I'll carry a keyboard with me. So in fact, I'm heading off to San Diego later for a conference next week. And so I'm probably going to carry my Microsoft Universal Keyboard so I can type stuff on my iPhone or my iPad. Of course, I have to repair from one to the other. So I usually use it with my iPhone. And it works really well. I will say, when you turn it on, it instantly recognizes, whereas my the folding keyboard usually would take, you know, like a minute or half a minute or something to pair. It just seemed to take a while, or I'd have to force the repair. And this one, the Microsoft Universal Keyboard, just once it's paired, it recognizes each other pretty quickly, if not immediately. So good
stuff.
Cool. Yep. Okay, and the next item is something we discussed last week, and that's Microsoft's alleged mobile strategy. So Mary Jo Foley from ZDNet, allaboutmicrosoft.com, got a chance to interview Microsoft CEO Nadella. And she asked him several times in a couple of different ways about Microsoft's mobile strategy. And he was not exactly evasive, but I don't think he ever answered her question.
Well, it's interesting. Depending on who you talk to, he did answer the question in either super positive ways about Windows Phone or super negative ways about Windows Phone or very noncommittal ways about Windows Phone.
Yeah.
What we know now is not anything new that we didn't know last week. Microsoft is still committed to mobile, not necessarily Windows Mobile, Windows Phone, but mobile operating systems to target their software to.
Yeah,
we know Microsoft makes money at that. We know that they have products that people use on Android and iOS, so that's no big surprise. And the statement that has been thrown around by the pro Windows Phone camp, the ones who do not want to see it go away, that you put in our show notes, the quote, if no OEM stands up to build Windows devices, we'll build them. There will be Lumia devices. No OEM, so not even one? I mean, that you could interpret that as even if there's one OEM building a Windows phone, then Microsoft will keep their hands out. That seems a little extreme. But on the other end, as we talked about last week, how do you lay off 7,800 people and shutter factories and still have the ability to crank out Lumia devices?
Yeah. So my conspiracy theory on this one is this. You know, HTC, which is I've always thought made very nice phones. I've had a number of HTCs, several of which were not under the HTC brand. Like I think the original, that was Compal. I was thinking about the original Pocket PC Phone Edition. But you know, there are a number of phones that we can probably think of that either had the HTC branding on it or made by HTC for other companies. My theory is because they are not doing well now, they will become a favored nation kind of Windows phone company secretly paid by Microsoft to actually build stuff, so it looks like somebody's interested in it. And
so they will be the Lumias, but they will not be Nokia Lumias. They will just be Lumias with no, you know, a tiny little print on the back that says made by HTC in Taiwan.
Or simply just branded HTC, not even Lumias. You know, they'll simply be Microsoft HTC phones, and they'll be the favorite brand. But yeah, or it could be like maybe Microsoft would come up like something like the Nexus project, you know, where they favor one company per year, or in their case, maybe one company forever, to build a Microsoft-branded product, but manufactured elsewhere. You know, the Nexus the first Nexus One was made by HTC.
Yeah. I think that's actually not a bad idea. HTC, it's clear, is not going to win the Android battle. They don't have enough money to stack up against Samsung.
Nobody does.
Nobody does, and they don't have anything else to fall back on, whereas LG has other things they can build. Yeah, you know. So so I think that HTC would be a perfect partner for Microsoft in kind of launching some phones, and because they're also one of the OEMs that's stuck with Windows Phone.
Yeah.
You know, they're still making Windows Phone devices.
Yeah.
So it would be really nice. It would be a great way for HTC to kind of get out of the Android business, which they are not going to win the battle on, and get into a business where they might have a chance. You know, if you took HTC's marketing team and said, no more Android phones, just market Windows 10 mobile phones, whatever they're called, you could actually get some serious market penetration, some serious marketing on that. HTC marketing is a lot better than Microsoft marketing.
Yeah, at least they're consistent.
Yes.
And, and you know, I don't know if they're, what their engineering team looks like, but at least in the past, they produced some really winning designs. And it'd be nice to see them get the lead role in designing some really nice phones. Not that the you know, post-Nokia Lumia phones weren't nice, but generally speaking, except for the camera, there weren't much to write home about, I thought.
No, they weren't anything special except the camera. Yeah. So if you took, you know, and there are already HTC One series phones that have Windows Phone on them, and they look very nice. I've watched reviews on them and everything else. So.
Yeah. Okay, now before the podcast began, John and I were talking about motivation and how fear and greed were you know, largest players in motivation. So this next session that John came up with, I attribute to it.
This is either fear or greed. It's mostly greed. Fear in that I always am looking for alternate solutions to things. So these are as a feature that I have titled "Secrets They" in quotes don't want you to know about.
Yeah, that's fear.
These are tools. Yes, these are tools that do the same thing that you can use a paid tool for at the fraction of a cost. And importantly, these are not tools that are junk. I've seen a lot of tools that, you know, use this and it works to do this or that, and it's a piece of junk. You don't want to use it anyway. You actually want to buy the tool that is the right tool. So my motivation is to kind of give some options to people who may have thought that these solutions, either there was only one option or didn't even know there was an option that was free.
Okay, why don't we start off with the first one then?
That's a good one. The first one is something that I just realized yesterday, actually. Adobe Acrobat, we all know that you can create PDFs with the full version of Acrobat. We all have seen Acrobat Reader to read them. You can use Preview on a Mac to read them. Hundreds of readers. But one of the things that we run across every so often are PDFs with fillable forms, where you can type in your information or whatever, then hit print, and it's all nicely printed out for you. And to create those forms, you typically need Adobe Acrobat, or you need some other product that costs a bunch of money. I think there's a few others where they're all in the $100, $120 range to be able to create these fillable forms. Or you can use LibreOffice, which is a free Office platform like OpenOffice. It's LibreOffice. I think they one time were both of the same code base, and then they split off.
Yeah, it's a fork of OpenOffice.
Yeah. So LibreOffice can export PDFs with fillable forms natively. So you go in, you add your form data, and export, and people can open up your PDF in any reader and type in information.
Yeah. I will offer two additional notes to that recommendation, and it's one, which is a good one. One is that while LibreOffice is mostly compatible with Microsoft Office components like Word and Excel and so forth, it's not 100% compatible, and I found that out the hard way. When I was given a bunch of documents, and because I didn't install Microsoft Office because I'm too greedy and cheap to do so on my new Windows, my then new Windows 8 notebook. This was a few months ago. So I opened the forms, and I saw one that was just a giant icon, and I thought, oh, this must be just like their image file, and I don't need to do anything with it. Well, it turned out that Word document was actually like a tax form I was supposed to fill out for some freelance work I'm doing. And they said, hey, you know, you forgot a form. I said, I did? He says, yeah, look for this file name and go fill it out for us, will you? And I look at it, all I see is a giant icon. So I had to actually import that into, again, I don't have Word installed on my notebook, my Windows notebook. So I had to import it into, what does Microsoft call their web-based Word, the Word Online or whatever they call it. And it's a holy cow, the icon is just one tiny part of the document. There's a whole tax form I have to fill out or something. So while you can create a PDF from LibreOffice, you may find a document or two that for whatever reason will not read properly, and you will not be able to create a PDF that makes sense, or you may not even know what it is you're looking at to create a PDF. The other one is if you are a Mac user, OS X can produce PDF files all by itself, generally
speaking. That is true.
So I don't know if they're fillable. I don't know if you can create fillable forms.
Nope.
But you can edit existing Acrobat forms without using any special software, just the Microsoft, with the OS X, what is the Viewer app?
Preview
app. And so it's a pretty good solution without even installing anything.
Yep, I always use Preview for my PDFs on Mac OS. So I the only need that I ever had was to eventually create PDF forms, which is a very rare thing I have to do. It's definitely not something I'm going to buy Acrobat to do.
Yeah, which is expensive.
Second up on my list, instead of purchasing books tied to one platform, so, you know, you buy your Kindle books or iBooks or whatever, you can download many free ebooks or strip the DRM off of the ebooks you own with a tool called Caliber. Caliber has been around for a few years now. It is an excellent, full-featured, open-source ebook management app. Mm. It even includes a built-in news feed download capability where it will download a number of news feeds every day for you and email them to you directly or place them in its content server, automatically deleting them after 30 days or whatever you want, 15 days, 60 days, whatever you want to set. And it also has a built-in content server, so a web server that you can ping. I have this running on a machine on my local network, and then from my iPad I can go to the web server, pull the book I want, download it in .epub format, and open it in iBooks on my iPad. So a very nice product there.
So is Caliber a soft piece of software, or is it a web service? Or
it's a piece of software.
And it runs on
what? Windows, Mac, or Linux.
Oh, pretty much anything. So it's open source?
Yep.
Nice. Nice.
It is definitely one of the best platforms. And it does, there are many plugins. So like I said, there are plugins that'll strip DRM so that if you bought an Amazon book, you know, for your Kindle years ago, but you'd really like to read it on your iPad without the Amazon app, or you really would like a PDF copy of it so that you can open it on an older machine that doesn't have the Amazon software, you can do all of that with Caliber.
Hey, out of curiosity, do you remember the ebook format for the Pocket PC from the early 2000s that no longer exists? Does it work with that?
It might, actually. That was .. Do you remember the extension on that?
I don't remember. I don't even remember the name of it. I remember it was a Microsoft product, and they had teamed up with, I think, Barnes & Noble or somebody.
I thought it might have been .mobi. But maybe Mobi is definitely a newer one that's still in.
That was a separate one,
but
we'll have to go back and take a look.
It might. You know, this software, Caliber, has been around since 2006.
Yeah.
And it there might be plugins for it that I haven't ever looked at.
I literally have about a dozen books in that format I still haven't read. Most of them are Star Trek books, but, you know.
Well, this is caliber-ebook.com if anyone is interested. It's not, just looking at it, it's not open source, but it is free.
Okay. So caliber-ebook.com.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Next up is one of my favorites.
Okay. So many of our listeners may have learned at some point the dark arts of statistical analysis, and you may have been taught that using a tool that costs next to a second mortgage on your house.
Or more.
Minitab, SPSS, SAS, Jump, Stata, whatever it might be. If you remember your college days and still have notes and say, boy, sometimes I'd like to do something that Excel just can't do, use R. R is the open source stats language or platform that's been around for, I guess, about 10, 15 years now, but it's starting to hit its prime. A lot of people are starting to write plugins and different libraries for it. So I know, Todd, you use R, and I'm a big R fan as well.
Yeah. A couple items on that. I haven't looked at it recently. I've used it recently, but I haven't, looked deeply into it. I think a recent update, like in the last couple of years, allows it to directly talk to database software like, Oracle or MySQL or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which means, it's really, which is why I think it has a resurgence in interest, which means you can really do big data stuff because you don't have to extract stuff from a database and deal with gigantic, text files and things to analyze. You can simply, draw directly from the database and do big data analysis. So that's pretty cool. The other thing is, if you are of a certain age, in other words, if you're old, you may recall that AT&T, was it AT&T? I'm pretty sure it was AT&T, used to have a language that they would sell to you on tape for your, you know, for your vaxes and things, called S. And R is essentially S. So if you have old S books, S for statistics, I assume, you can apply pretty much everything you read in that to R. You may not even have to learn anything new if you're an old S programmer.
That is true. And there are, just because R is a programming language in of itself, you can Google pretty much how to do blank in R and you will find how to do it. So the learning curve is not as steep as it used to be with R.
Right. And you can find R at r-project.org.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
We've talked about this next one quite a bit in the last few weeks, but instead of using iCloud Photos and paying for your storage, or maybe you have a storage plan for your iCloud backups and you don't necessarily want to waste a lot of that on movie files, Google Photos is an easy solution. Amazon also will do unlimited if you have Prime, but Google Photos is definitely my platform of choice now to have a photo library with me wherever I go.
Yeah. I will note two things I've noticed over the last couple of weeks, and I agree with you, it's terrific. Especially since it's free and unlimited if you, you know, restrict your photos to under 16 megapixels and your videos to under 1080p, you know, at or under.
And unless you have one of those Lumia cameras, you probably are shooting in under 16 megapixels anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you have a high-end point-and-shoot or, you know. But the two things I've noticed the last couple of years, one, and on my iPads, not so much my iPhone, but on my iPads, sometimes the photos from the cloud don't appear in the Google Photos app. Like for a while, I was missing every, but I couldn't see any of the photos I took in July, you know, basically this month on my iPad mini. They're there. You know, I can go to the web. I can see them. I can, you know, go on my iPhone's Google Photos app and I can see them. So I knew they were there. They weren't like missing or disappeared. They just didn't show up. I'm not quite sure what the problem there is. And number two, I think we've mentioned this before, but it does have a problem with RAW photos, at least my Canon RAW photos, which is okay. You know, I can understand that. And number three, I guess not two things, three things. Number three is that it doesn't upload all the photos from at least your iOS devices. And I'm not quite sure how I can force that. You know, I've got a couple of things I've synced to my, you know, my iPad or iPhone. And I would like to upload the Google Photos because I can't remember where I put them on my desktop, which is kind of weird, you know, because I thought I'd stored every single photo I ever took on, you know, with this one desktop that I back up religiously to, you know, a couple of external drives and things, but they don't have them, so I'd really like to upload those photos, but it's just something. Okay, next up.
Next up, this is something we talked about a year ago when I wrote this article, but this is continually the top article on my blog, and so I figured I'd give it a shout out again. If you liked having pushed Gmail into your iOS device and then lost that when you upgraded, so you were grandfathered into Exchange through Google and then Google took that away, I have a solution on my blog that basically uses a secondary iCloud account that you can set up for free. And at the end of the day, you are sending and receiving through your Gmail or Google Apps address. So even the from header when you send out is still the correct address, but you are getting it push notified to your native iPhone or iPad email client. Mm-hmm. So we'll put the link up with the show notes. But if you just actually, if you Google Gmail push, I'm like one of the top two results. So. that has been a solution that a lot of people have liked over the last year, a lot of comments, a lot of people saying it's worked out really well for them.
Yeah, and if you can't wait for the show notes, head over to John, J-O-N, Westfall, just like it sounds, .com, and go search for it. I'm sure you can find it there.
Yeah, it'll be right there. So that is something to give a shout-out to. The next thing is something for kind of our younger listeners. I think our older listeners know about this technology, but younger listeners may not. Recently, I've seen a lot of companies kind of pop up, and their big thing is secure messaging. Come to this website, and you can have a secure chat with someone else, and you give them a little link, and it's all encrypted, blah, blah, blah. And it reminded me that there is a very easy encryption tool that has been around for a very long time, and that is public-private key encryption, PGP/GPG if you're using the new set of tools instead of the old PGP tools. Those are free. You can generate your own public-private key, share your public key, keep your private key private, and send and receive emails. In fact, Facebook now has a feature that I've enabled where every notification that it sends me is PGP encrypted.
Hmm.
So when I am looking, I go, is that a real Facebook notification, or is that a piece of spam or a phishing notification or something? I know immediately, because if it's not encrypted, it's not real.
Interesting.
So that is something I just mentioned, that just search for PGP, and you will find out a lot of tools that you may not have known about.
Yeah. And in general, if you're interested in security and keeping sensitive information, you know, secure, that they're good tools.
And if you, the best rule that I can ever say is you never send a password over anything other than an encrypted email.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right, next up. If you are an academic or a pseudo-academic or a student who's been forced to be an academic and you have a lot of reference materials that you need to collect, there are a number of pieces of software out there. There's one called Papers for macOS. EndNote is kind of the old original in this category. But there's a product called Mendeley that I don't hear too many people talk about. Mendeley has desktop and mobile clients for all the major operating systems. You can have your entire library of citations, references, and attached PDFs. So if you have the full article that you'd like to keep attached. And for signing up, you get 2 gigabytes of free sync data. So for me, that's plenty for my articles. Mine are just big PDFs. So, but it's a nice way when you're talking with someone, you go, oh, there's a paper that talks about that. You can pop open Mendeley on your iPhone or on your Android device and even, you know, find the exact abstract, email it to them, etc. So Mendeley is an excellent, excellent free piece of software. They make their money on getting people to buy the team and professional subscriptions where you have much more storage space. But if you don't care about storage space, if you just want a decent tool and networking tool, you can share collections of resources with other people. So if you're writing a paper with a colleague, you can both share the same reference library and add citations, etc. And it's got a Word export tool, so you can get your bibliography or works cited page popped right out in APA or whatever other format you want. So that's a tool I would highly recommend, Mendeley.
Any idea where the name comes from? I mean, it's not obvious what it does from the name.
No, and it's I think there's probably, if you go on their website, a long history of why they chose that. But
okay.
I know they've been around for about 6 years now.
Okay.
And it's sad that not more people know about them.
Okay. And next up is an alternative to what we're using to record this podcast right now.
Yeah, if you are using macOS, this is unfortunately not a cross-platform application, but with Windows, I know there are applications that do this, and you need to grab audio data. So, you know, you're playing something on your computer, you want to record that, or you want to record a Skype call, or you want to record something that isn't easily recordable. There is a free utility made by the same people who make Audio Hijack, rogueamoeba.com, called Soundflower. And Soundflower is basically a dummy audio device that appears in your multimedia config. And you select it, and all of the data that it would normally pump out to a speaker gets pumped into that. So then you open up any sort of audio recorder like Audacity and just select Soundflower as the input, and you can record straight away. And it even comes with a nice little utility called Soundflower Bed that lets you then take the output of Soundflower and put it through the speaker. So you're not losing your speaker ability. You just kind of have Soundflower sitting between the audio source data on your computer and the speaker output.
Right. And just for folks who are interested in doing this sort of thing, so this is a free way to do it. But as you can tell from John's description, it does take a little bit of configuration and thinking through. Whereas Audio Hijack Pro, which is a paid service, and I'm still using the previous version, by the way. I've never upgraded because I'm afraid to. well, you know, this works, right?
Yeah, yep.
Audio Hijack Pro is basically you click a button and choose a file name.
Yep. And a lot of my solutions, as I will freely admit, are not at the beginner level or even the new intermediate. They are definitely for power users who understand a little bit more and would rather have flexibility versus easy, you know, dummy-proof instructions.
Right. So it's a kind of a DIY for software.
DIY, but do it, in this case, as well as you could do it in any other way.
Yeah.
The last one is really kind of a cop-out, but the second to last one, instead of paying for clip art or stock photography, Flickr has an advanced search option, if you remember Flickr, that lets you search for photos licensed under Creative Commons. And there are a number of deviants of the Creative Commons license. You can select which ones you want to search. But if you pick the right license type, you can even use it for commercial purposes as long as you have attribution somewhere in your product. So I found that I can usually find something on Flickr for anything I need. And it's a great way in my blog posts and even the cover of my novel a few years ago to give a shout out to an amateur photographer and say, look, here's a nice shot and here's where I got it. And if it's licensed properly, you can use it for any purpose you'd like.
That's nice.
And the last piece of things, I do have two things at the bottom here that are things I think are worth paying for. The last thing is if you pay for Hulu and Netflix and you find that you don't really find a lot that you're looking for because you're not into dramas, you're not into sitcoms, you just kind of like documentaries or how-to videos or something like that, give our old friend YouTube a try. If you haven't been on YouTube since kind of Hulu and Netflix came out and you've kind of thought of YouTube as that place where people post funny videos and it's kind of junky stuff, you'd be surprised at the number of high-quality channels of just a lot of tech information, a lot of documentary information, a lot of things that people put together with their fans of different things. So it might be worth an afternoon just looking through and seeing if there's stuff there that you might not have thought about. Similarly, TED Talks. I use TED Talks all the time in my teaching. They're between 8 and 18 minutes. They have kind of two levels, either the 8-minute talk or the 20-minute talk. Definitely great ideas that you may agree with, may disagree with, but will definitely give you something to think about. And both of those sites, YouTube and TED, are free versus Hulu and Netflix.
Right. And then just a step above funny cat videos. If you use YouTube to watch music, here's a tip that's not exactly free, but it's freeing. If you are currently a paying subscriber to Google's other service, Google All Access Music, if you go to YouTube, you'll find that many of the commercial music videos no longer have advertisements. And that happens automatically. You don't need to check a box or click an option. It just happens if you are a subscriber at $10 a month. I'm grandfathered in at $8 a month. Thank you, Google. but if you like to watch music videos, you know, and you don't like the commercials, the $8 a month will make that go away, and you'll get Google All Access Music, which is, you know, kind of like Spotify or Apple's new whatever they call their thing, Apple Music, I guess.
Yes.
Tools that cost a bit more. We think we have time to throw that in.
Yeah. So these are just two things that I do think are worth paying the money for if you find that you have the same frustrations I do. The first is on macOS and iOS, a tool called Tweetbot. Instead of using the Twitter built-in client, Tweetbot is kind of a more full-featured client. And the thing that it gives me that one of my friends said, hey, you know, this does this, and I immediately went out and bought it, was it marks where you left off reading your Twitter stream. So if you've got a lot of people you're following, you really don't want to miss things, but you also don't want to chop down your following list to like five people, you can open this up. And usually every time I open it, there's about 20, 25 new tweets that I can go through quickly and not miss anything, especially for little area businesses and such that post their specials each day or something like that that I might often miss in my Facebook feed. I like having that in Twitter. And so Tweetbot is a very nice client if you're not happy with the free client.
How does Tweetbot get around Twitter's API limitation?
The fact that you pay for them. I'm assuming they've cut a paying deal with Twitter.
Okay, because other apps, paid or not, have kind of disappeared because they basically ran out of tokens or something, right?
Yeah, and Tweetbot, for whatever reason, since probably because they are a paid product, and you are paying, you're not just using kind of a freemium version. Every version they have is paid. And, you know, the clients cost between $4 and $10 each. You can fund a deal with Twitter to get by the API limitations.
Okay, fair enough.
And then the last thing, and we can harp on this a lot, but instead of using your brain or a list or a little booklet or something you scrawled on the back of a napkin, or the power of prayer when you forget them, use LastPass or 1Password or some other password keeper to rest easy at night. LastPass, the basic level of it is free. The mobile clients will add another $12 a year. 1Password on iOS and Mac and Windows will be a little bit more, but it's a one-time fee that you don't pay again. So definitely don't skimp when it comes to trying to remember stuff. Now, you could just go the cheap route and have all of your stuff in a text file that you encrypt using PGP or something like mm-hmm. that. But this will be a little bit easier and probably make you more likely to actually use it.
Now how do LastPass and 1Password work? Are they, you know, like apps that you simply, you know, decrypt and look at your passwords, or do they interact with a browser, or how do they
both
work?
Both of them do have the ability to interact with your browser to mm-hmm. fill in things directly. In fact, 1Password now, there are some iOS apps that will interact with it directly mm-hmm. to fill in your login information into the app. Their back-end model is a little different. So 1Password, you have an encrypted archive file that you keep somewhere in your own storage, so either on your own computer or in Dropbox. You can use Dropbox to sync or iCloud to sync, and I think they have another couple of sync solutions. But it's one physical file that you have somewhere on a device. LastPass takes your information and encrypts it on your device and sends it to their server as an encrypted blob of data, and any of the decryption that they do happens on your device as well. So if, in theory, someone were to hack into LastPass's website and steal all of those blobs, they would be completely worthless because there's no way to decrypt them unless you're using your key, which only lives on your computer when you type it into the software.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I'm still using eWallet, which is what I've used since, I don't know, 2000, something like that. I'm using eWallet Go, which is a weird descendant.
But you're a loyalist.
I simply have not found a way. I mean, I know I can. I've exported to XML for safety, and they encrypted that separately. But I have not yet found a tool to, you know, easily export everything to. And I've got, not that I need them all, but I've probably got thousands of pieces of information in eWallet Go.
And I think I've shared with you off the podcast, yeah. but there's a product that's an open source product called KeePass.
Yeah, you have mentioned that.
KeePass, and KeePass has some limitations. It only runs really well on Windows machines, but it can import from eWallet, and you can then use 1Password or LastPass to import from KeePass. So it's one way to move from eWallet and that family and a lot of other families to one central standard that has then been adopted by LastPass and 1Password. KeePass, due to its plug-in nature, has gotten a lot of fans, and there are people that use it today that don't care about browser integration or things like that.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I wanted to add to the tools that cost a bit more but are totally worth it is a tie-in to what you mentioned earlier about Hulu and Netflix. Now, I do enjoy watching, you know, dramas and comedies and sci-fi and whatever, in addition to nonfiction kinds of content like TED. And I do have a Netflix account, and I do have an Amazon Prime, you know, instant video account.
Full disclosure, I have those as well. So.
Yeah. but the problem for me is while they do have, if you like content that you may have never seen before, and even more importantly, are not produced in either the U.S. or the U.K., in other words, in English, there are other sources. Now, both Netflix and Amazon Prime do have content, fictional, you know, TV shows, not fictional, basically have TV shows and movies from other countries, but it's really not a lot of stuff, and it's really not, you know, as many as you might like. So there are two paid but reasonably priced streaming video services that you may not have heard of if you're interested in videos from other countries. And you know, believe it or not, other countries do produce TV shows and videos. Some of them are much more entertaining than ours, to be honest. So one is Viki.com, Viki.com, which has a volunteer translator, you know, army that and they have licenses. This is legal stuff. You pay, it's about $4 a month, I think, to get rid of the commercials. And they have a volunteer army that translates shows. So sometimes the shows come out a little later than you would like, but at $4 a month, it's not a bad way to go. And they do have some exclusives that are not on any other streaming video services. And the other one is DramaFever.com, which if you pay an annual fee, comes down to a little over $4 a month. I think it's, like $45 a year or something for an annual fee. And again, to get rid of the commercials. Otherwise, you can watch it. You can watch for free on both of them, Viki.com and DramaFever, if you're willing to put up with commercials every couple of minutes. And they tend to have their content come up much faster. I would say the one difference I've noticed in having subscribed to both of them is that the Viki.com translators, which again are volunteers, tend to be a little bit better than Drama Fever in pointing out idiosyncratic translations. Like, this is what they're referring to, you know, when somebody says a joke or a historical reference that, you know, we in America are completely, unaware of because we don't actually study other countries' histories.
Yes.
Or, just a colloquialism that would make no sense to you unless somebody explained it to you, why something is called something. So, anyway, Viki.com, DramaFever.com, reasonably priced at about $4 a month. And if you're interested in, and they do have actually English, like from Australia and stuff too, I think. But if you want to see content from all over the world, they're really good sources. I really enjoy them, especially since most of the American shows I watch on Netflix are old shows that, I haven't seen in so long, I've forgotten what they actually were. Like, I'm watching NCIS now on Netflix. And I swear, I've seen the whole series, but, going through season one, it's like, I don't remember this episode at all. And quite frankly, if you want to see fun stuff, other countries' writers are quite good, especially South Korea. I really love the K-dramas from there. But anywho, so that is our wrap-up of Mobile Views Podcast number 123. And we'll have a little bit of a hiatus unless I can corral some other people in John's absence. But when we do come back, I'm sure we're going to one of the topics will be Windows 10 launch. Especially interested to see if any interesting notebooks emerge along, unique to Windows 10 for whatever reason. So I'm hoping to see that. And I will be traveling, John will be traveling. So safe travels to us all. And we'll talk to you.
And we might run across you randomly in our travels.
So that'd be hilarious.
That would be very strange. But we will do a personal podcast for about 5 minutes if we find any listeners.
Yeah, we probably haven't seen each other in person in about 4 or 5 years, I think.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'll have to, if one of us is there, we'll call the other and we'll, do 5 minutes for any listener that stops us and say, "You're the guy from Mobile Views." I don't think it'll ever happen, but if it does.
Yeah. Especially since we only record audio. But it would be pretty funny. It wouldn't be even funnier if I saw you in person and go, "John?" I mean, I see you on Skype all the time, but it's still different.
I have that Skype filter on that added the goatee and mustache.
That's right. That's right. You don't actually look like that.
Yeah.
All righty. Talk to you guys next time.